Lecture 21, Origins of Modernism.
This lecture will focus on a paradigm shift that took place a century ago and that set the groundwork for modern theory. Our exploration of this shift will fall naturally into two parts. First, we shall define and explore logocentrism, a theological, philosophical, and theoretical orientation that has dominated Western thought since Plato. Then, we shall show how the theories of Freud, Darwin, Marx, and Nietzsche disrupted this established framework, opening the door for a radically new way of viewing the nature of reality, of meaning, of thought, and of art. Beginning in the Victorian age, late 19th century, a paradigm shift slowly spread through Europe that set the groundwork for modern theory. Unlike the revolutionary movements of the Renaissance and Romanticism, which were in part reactionary, this paradigm shift marked a radical break with the past that had little precedent. What do I mean when I say Renaissance and Romanticism are in part reactionary? Well, think about it. The Renaissance is very revolutionary, but really it's an attempt to go back to the classical age. So it is as much reactionary as revolutionary. Even the Romantic age, born out of the French Revolution, is in some ways an attempt to go back to the Middle Ages and other kinds of things, to skip over the Age of Reason. So again, a lot of what we call revolutionary movements have a slight reactionary or backward-looking quality. I would argue that the paradigm shift we're going to discuss in this lecture is really a break. It's a break with a metaphysic that goes from Plato right up to the modern day. Indeed, I will argue, this paradigm shift marked a rejection of a long-held metaphysical and aesthetic belief that most theorists from Plato to Coleridge just took for granted. So far in this series, what I'm going to tell you now, we have pretty much taken for granted all the way up to this lecture. That's how pervasive what I'm going to tell you is. In this lecture, then, we shall first define the nature of those beliefs. What is this metaphysic that reigns from Plato to Coleridge and a little beyond? And then we'll show how the four fathers of modernism, again, Freud, Darwin, Marx, and Nietzsche, disrupted them and thus set in motion the modernist paradigm shift. That will be this lecture. Then in the succeeding lectures, we will trace the impact of this shift. And so in lecture 22, we will take up the modernist school of structuralism. Then in lecture 23, we will trace how in 1966, the modernist paradigm was actually shifted again to make way for a postmodern deconstructive approach to theory. And then finally, in our 24th and final lecture, we will trace various theoretical schools that all share a distinctly postmodern paradigm. All right. Until the modern period, most of the great Western philosophers have been logocentric in their thinking. What is logocentric, or what are logocentrists? Well, logocentrists consider meaning to emanate finally from some logos or originary source that is pure and undefiled. I mentioned in the last lecture, John uses the word logos or word to refer to Christ. But again, like the word incarnation, logos has a more general meaning. Logos refers to origins, to something that is the origin of everything else. A logos refers to something that is pure and undefiled, that exists in what Plato calls the world of being. So logocentrism literally is centered on the logos. The center of its philosophy, its metaphysic, is the logos, this origin, this originary source, is a phrase that's often used. Now, examples of this logos would include Plato's forms. That's the first example of a logos. John's logos is a logos. Augustine obviously agrees with John, but Augustine tends to speak more of the Trinity as the source or origin of everything. In Descartes, mind is often seen as the source, the cogito. Kant often speaks of the thing in itself. Hegel speaks of the idea as the origin. Coleridge speaks of God as I am that I am. I'm being very loose here, and we can add a lot of different things here. But the idea is that as you go through the history of metaphysics, Most people believe in a logos, but they change its name, or they change its slight location, but they're still centered on the logos as an origin. Now, sometimes in the work of radical epistemologists, this logos will become internalized and will become known as the absolute self or the transcendent ego. In other words, sometimes they'll take the logos out of the sky, so to speak, and put it inside of us so that the transcendent ego, our inner being, becomes a logos or a center of meaning. But still, the idea is that there is a center, there is an origin that is somehow pure. Now, most logocentric philosophers will provide for the expression of this logos through a sensuous incarnation into the physical or material world. The best example we had was our lecture on Hegel, lecture 12, where we saw that the logos wants to come into the world and be incarnated in some way, that this pure origin wants to reveal itself in some way. Plato was a little suspicious of that, but most logocentrists after him seek some kind. I mean, if there's no sensuous incarnation at all, how can we know anything about the logos? Even a little bit, how can we know if it doesn't come into our world in some way? Now, therefore, let's talk about aesthetics. The best art, therefore, is that which most fully realizes the logos. Such art is transcendent. It expresses and encapsulates truths that are eternal and lie outside any given historical period. If you think, we've heard this before. Okay? Art, judged logocentrically, the best art is, again, what expresses the logos, what realizes it in a physical form, what embodies it, as we've seen many times now. Indeed, as in Hegel, the success of this incarnation often functions as the supreme standard or touchstone against which all art is measured. The final measure of art, the touchstone, the standard, the criterion, or criteria, really plural, against which it is, how well does it match up to this? How well does it express the logos? That's how you should judge art. That's a traditional way of looking at art. And almost all of our theorists, in one way or another, are interested in that and believe that in one angle or perspective or another. Now, within such works of art, from a logocentric point of view, meaning is ever imminent. The meaning is there in the work of art, and yet its final point of reference lies above the physical constraints of time and space. In other words, the final function of art and of all language itself is to point back to meaning. In other words, art is a means to a higher end, to point back to meaning. Now, I have contradicted myself a little bit because Kant and his tradition tends to say art is an end in itself. And again, you know, I'm trying to give you a package that will include thousands of years. But even there, I don't think there's a huge contradiction, because even though Kant believes art is an end in itself, he still believes art points to a higher kind of reality, just not a scientific, pragmatic kind of meaning or reality, but it still points to some kind of truth. Even for the new critics, I really think that they finally believe that that poem is touching on some kind of higher meaning. Like I told you, Christ spoke in parables, ironic parable. I mean, in that sense, I think even the Kantians and the neo-Kantians would agree to a certain extent that art really should point back to some higher meaning that we want to get a hold of. All right. Let me give you another aspect now of logocentrism. Logocentrism generally expresses itself through binaries. What are binaries? A binary is a set of two related terms in which the first term, which is perceived to be closer to the logos, is privileged over the second term. There's two terms, and the first term is privileged over the second term because the first term is seen to be closer to the logos, to the origin. Indeed, the second term is often seen as a falling away from the first, sort of like world of being to world of becoming, sort of like the first term of the binary and the second term of the binary. Now, the most famous and most defining binary is to be found in Plato, where the idea or form is always given precedence over the image or mimesis of this idea. So form is the first term, the imitation is the second term, or the idea is the first term, and the image is the second term. Plato, in many ways, is the founder of logocentrism. Now, what are some other binaries? We might also add soul as the first, and then body as the second. Or logos as the first, and another Greek word, praxis, as the second. If logos means word and logic and speech, praxis means action, experience, writing. So, believe it or not, it's often believed in logocentrism that speech is higher than writing, because speech is purer. God, again, spoke the world into being. Writing is a little bit of a movement away from the logos. It's a movement away from pure speech. So logos is privilege over praxis, which is activity sort of in this world, experience in this world. Being privileged over becoming. The intellectual privileged over the physical. Conscious over unconscious. Essence over existence. Genius over art. Rational over emotional. And one more, Apollonian over Dionysiac. And I can add, you know, more and more to these things, but you hopefully have the idea by now. Now, in general, that which is closer to perfection, to the eternal, to that which is unchanging, is privileged over that which alters or decays. Now, again, there are little contradictions here and there. Romantics tend to switch things a little bit. But in general, the first term is what they think is closer to what is eternal and unchanging, the logos, and that's going to be privileged in some ways over what is farther away. Now, interestingly, feminist critics today accuse logocentrism of being patriarchal, okay, the rule of the father, and add the following binaries: male, female, white, non-white, Western, non-Western, canonical, non-canonical. And there is some truth there. Okay, what they're saying is that oftentimes the masculine is seen as the first term and the feminine as a little bit of a falling away. Okay, so there is some truth there. Now, binaries, so far I've described to you binaries in vertical terms. In other words, the first binary is up, the second binary is down, from the world of being down to the world of becoming. But, interestingly, binaries can also be viewed in horizontal spatial terms, with the first term acting as the center and the second term as the margin. So we either go from up to down or from the center to the margin. One's vertical, one's horizontal, but it's still the same basic binary mindset of first and second term. Now, let's come back to feminists, because they've criticized this too. When feminist critics argue that women and minorities have traditionally been marginalized, you've heard that word, I'm sure, they are speaking in sociopolitical terms, of course, but they're also speaking in metaphysical aesthetic terms. And I think there's a truth here too. What they're saying is that the masculine has always been put at the center of ideologies and philosophies, and the feminine has been pushed a little bit to the margin. So you don't have to be a full-fledged feminist to see that. I mean, but there are ones that have pointed that out. And again, I think there's some truth to that. Now, one more thing. In general, Platonists tend to think vertically, from up to down, whereas Aristotelians tend to think horizontally, from center to margin. Remember, Aristotle took meaning out of the sky and put it within, in the center. And so, when someone says, I'm looking for higher meanings, and someone else says, I'm looking for deeper meanings, it's really the same thing. They're either trying to go up or towards the center. Higher and deeper mean the same thing, metaphysically, in terms of logocentrism. Isn't that interesting? All right, now you hopefully understand logocentrism. Now let me show you how our four fathers of modernism disrupted this. First of all, Freud and Darwin, as fathers of modernism, disrupted these age-old binaries. They broke with them. They disrupted. That's the paradigm shift. Now, this disruption generally takes one of two forms. Either the poles of the binary are switched so that up-down becomes down-up, okay? So you either switch it around, switch the poles, or the center and the margin are juxtaposed in a process known as decentering. So either flip the vertical or invert the horizontal, if you can kind of get a spatial image of that in your mind. Let me give you examples that will make it clear. First, Freud. Think about it. Before Freud, the conscious mind was privileged over the unconscious. We felt that consciousness was the first thing and unconsciousness was a sort of creation of it. Freud, the modernist, inverted this established binary, positing the unconscious mind as the true source or origin of conscious thought. You see, now the unconscious is now the logos, the origin, and consciousness is just a creation almost of the unconscious mind. You see how that is a shift or a juxtaposition? Another example from Freud. Before Freud, mental normalcy, in quotes, was placed at the center of society, and neurotics were marginalized both culturally and institutionally. That which is normal was the center of society, and all those neurotics and people with neuroses were put out to the margin, not only in a, you know, in a psychological sense, but even institutionally, you know, put out there on the margins of society. Freud decentered this view, positing neurosis as the norm through which society and humanity should be viewed. Heck, today, even normal people, quote, suffer from some type of neurosis. Now, neuroses is at the center. Everybody's got a neurosis or a phobia or something. That's the new center of society, and or the center of the person, I guess we might want to say. And now, if you are, quote, normal, if that even exists, you belong out in the margin. You see that? That's, I think, an easy way to get us thinking about this juxtaposition. All right, let's move to Darwin. A similar inversion or decentering or juxtaposition occurs in Darwinian evolution. Think about it. In evolution, the physical side of man, rather than the spiritual side of man, is now brought to the center. Now at the center is not our soul or our spirit, but our physical body, our animal body. And now humanity is seen to proceed not downward from spirit, not from God and spirit down to man, but upward from matter. So in other words, we weren't created. We didn't come from the mind of God down. Now we turn it around. We started as matter and we evolved, right? This is a sort of animal evolution. Now, I would argue that the myth of evolution is as vital to modernism as the ancient theories of creation are central to logocentrism. And let's admit it, creation and evolution are both myths. It takes just as much faith to believe in either one. We cannot prove either one of them, though they've tried. They are both myths, okay? Now, you know, the change within species maybe is not a myth, but the idea of the full evolution, it's a myth. We can't prove either that. We certainly can't prove creation. They're both myths, but that's important, because what are myths? Myths are things that we found our culture on. Well, if logocentrism is founded on the myth of creation, then the modernist paradigm is founded on evolution. Now listen here. The modern debate between evolution and creation, which is still going on, it's more than a dispute over 6 literal or figurative days. Sometimes we get caught up in all this little stuff. Oh, is it a literal day, a figurative day? There's something more going on. The real battle between creation and evolution, or what it should be, is really a battle over which paradigm, logocentrism or modernism, should rule society. There are two different ways of looking at reality and at ourselves. Do we come from God? Is spirit first and then matter? Do we come down, or do we start down there and come up? Let me just give you an example here off the cuff that will help you. All right, traditionally, biblically, both Jews and Christians had this belief. When we were created, we were all monotheists, right? We began as monotheists because we knew God. Then, because of sin and ignorance and whatnot, we fell away, and we fell from monotheism into polytheism, into pantheism, into animism. That's what the Bible shows if you read Genesis. But what do most modern people believe, especially starting with Sir James Frazer and all the kind of stuff that was going on in the late 19th century? We now believe that all mankind started what? As animists, as little savages running around. Then we worked our way up, or we evolved our way from animism to pantheism to polytheism, and finally up to the monotheism of Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And some people would say, we got to go beyond that to science now. That's the new religion. But do you see what I mean? Again, I don't know that either one of those is more true or more not. They're two different orientations. They're two different ways of looking at reality, of where meaning came from, of where we came from. And you've got to understand that you can't have modernism without evolution. Because to have modernism, you've got to have a way for us to get here without God or anything spiritual or any kind of logos. You understand? They're very important, metaphysically speaking. Let me give you another parallel. This new evolutionary modernist orientation may also be seen in the work of the German theological school of higher criticism. Some of you have studied that, maybe at the teaching company even. All right, the traditional view for Jews and Christians was that Moses wrote the first 5 books, the Pentateuch or the Torah, right? That was the traditional belief, that Moses wrote them. under God's inspiration. But most people today believe what this German school of higher criticism taught. They're modernists. They're evolutionary minded. They said, no, Moses did not write the Pentateuch or the Torah. What the Pentateuch is a book or five books that was written and rewritten, edited and re-edited over thousands of years. Moses had nothing to do with it. Moses didn't write it. It was written. Some of you are familiar with the phrase J-E-P-D. I don't have time to go into it. It's called the documentary hypothesis. But the idea is that the Pentateuch evolved. It wasn't so much written, but it evolved. Now think about that. To say that Moses wrote the five books is a sort of creationist way of thinking, because it says the five books of Moses were the creation of a single mind. And of course, behind that mind was the mind of God. That's a logocentric way of looking at it. The modernist way is more evolutionary. It says, let me put it to you in a funny way. Moses did not write the five books. The five books wrote Moses. You see that? Some people might even deny that Moses existed. The five books invented him. Isn't that interesting? There's a difference there. Which one's true? I can't prove either one to you. But those are, I want you to see the difference in paradigm. The difference in approach to what way. Now, you know what's interesting? A shift occurred in the classical studies of Homeric authorship. At the same time the Germans were sort of dethroning Moses, the Germans and the British were dethroning Homer. Everybody in the past believed that Homer wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, or at least, you know, combined it and put it together in the oral tradition. A lot of modernists now say, no, the Iliad and the Odyssey is a process of evolution. You know, we all believe in the oral tradition, but beyond that, okay? I mean, everybody believes in the oral tradition, but some people say Moses gathered the oral tradition. Others say it was evolution. Some say Homer gathered the oral tradition. Others say, again, the Iliad and the Odyssey invented or created Homer. I hope you're seeing the difference here. And again, I don't want to say one's right or one's the other wrong, but what I'm saying is this is two radically different ways of looking at art, of looking at ourselves, of looking at the nature of reality. Now, by the way, there are very few people that are pure logocentrists or pure modernists. Most of us sort of pick and choose, but I'm giving you the pure version, so to speak. All right, that's Freud and Darwin. But more radical decenterings were affected by Marx and Nietzsche. All right, Marx, as both an atheist and a materialist, denied the real existence of anything beyond the physical. Now, please, unfortunately, we have such nasty discourse these days that if I call someone an atheist, it sounds like I'm saying they're immoral or unethical. No, nothing. If you're an atheist, you may be moral, you may be immoral, just like a Christian can be moral or immoral. If you're an atheist, all that means is you don't believe in God. But Marx went beyond that. He was a materialist because he didn't believe that there was anything supernatural. You know, no angels, no, you know, nothing. In other words, all there is the physical. We sort of talked about this in the Coleridge lecture. That's what materialism. Marx denied the existence of anything beyond physical matter. For Marx, now listen carefully, the base or structure of society is the economic means and modes of production upon which rests the social, political, and intellectual superstructure. That takes some explanation. All right, some of you know a little bit about Marx. Marx believed that the way society works is that all of society is created by economic forces. At the base or structure of society is, again, what he calls the economic means and modes of production, whether you're feudal or capitalistic or slave, you know, all the different ways of economic structures. Now, for Marx, it is, and most people don't realize this sometimes, for Marx, those economic forces determine everything else. In other words, our philosophy, our religion, our aesthetics, all of that is determined by economic and sometimes socioeconomic forces. So what am I saying? For Marx, meaning starts with the physical, with the base, and moves upward towards philosophy and aesthetics. Again, a way to put it, thought flows upward from the base. Again, ideology, art, even consciousness itself are determined by economic forces and can never be independent of them. To Marx, the greatest illusion would be our view of our founding fathers in America. This view that a bunch of these great, you know, dead white men got together and had an idea, and out of their ideas, their philosophies and beliefs, they created a system of democratic capitalism. Marx would say that's an illusion, okay? The founding fathers did not create capitalism. Capitalism created the founding fathers. You see how it's just like the Moses I told you? All right, Marx is inverting a binary. Human ideas do not create historical forces. Historical forces are the origin of human ideas. And so again, What is the upshot of this? The upshot of this is that art and even consciousness have no separate existence, no inherent meaning that can transcend their economic milieu. And so, here's the link to aesthetics. In Marx's system, art loses its transcendent status because if it is unable to break free from socio-political forces, then it cannot hope to express truth. Again, you see, if even art is a product of a certain economic structure, means and modes of economic production, then how can you say art is eternal or touches on absolute truth or anything like that? It is just a creation, just like a machine is a creation or anything. It's a cultural product. So it's no longer transcendent, something that can encapsulate ideas. So Shakespeare is no longer for all time. He is for his age. He is a product of his socioeconomic milieu. Again, a lot of people don't realize that side of Marx, but that side of Marx has had a profound influence on literary theory. Obviously, I'm going to be a little biased here. I think that it's a little bit more negative than positive, but whatever we think, we need to understand it because it is very, very strongly influenced our view of ourselves and society, but for us, our view of art. All right, the more modernist Nietzsche went even farther. He broke down the old logocentric faith in the accessibility and even possibility of meaning. It'll take a few minutes to explain that. First of all, I want to tell you that most people, when they think about Nietzsche and the reversing of binaries, are going to go to that Apollo or Apollonian and Dionysiac thing. In The Birth of Tragedy and early Nietzsche work, he inverted that binary. He said, no, I don't want to privilege the Apollonian. I want to privilege the Dionysiac, that ecstatic side. But you know what? To me, that's not really that modernist. Why? First of all, the Romantics did it before him anyway. But it's also not that modernist because if the reason you like the Dionysiac is that it's because it's a kind of ecstatic possession that takes us out of our bodies, well, you're really saying there's a logos then, right? Because if you're being ecstatically possessed and inspired by something, something's got to be inspiring you. So, in other words, to me, this is not the most radical side of Nietzsche because it still allows for some kind of origin or logos that's the origin of our ideas. It's something that possesses us. To me, the real modernist Nietzsche comes in his later works, particularly in an essay he wrote called Truth and Falsity in an Ultra-Moral Sense. In this work, Nietzsche denies the existence of any logos or form. There is no such thing as a logos. There is no such thing as absolute truth or absolute beauty. Why? In this essay, Nietzsche argues that what we call truth or absolute truth with a capital T is finally an illusion that man constructed and then forgot. He constructed it. Let me give you a nice, easy example. Let's say I'm an ancient Greek living in Athens. I carve myself a little idol of Athena, and I put it behind a bush. And then I go away on a long journey. 30 years later, I come back to the same place, and I'm poking behind the bush, and lo and behold, I find the idol, the statue. And you know what I say? Zeus be praised! Athena has given us this idol of herself. What have I forgotten? That I created the darn thing in the beginning. Well, that's what Nietzsche, I'm simplifying it, but that's really what Nietzsche says absolute truth is. We created it, we created the system, we created logocentrism, and then forgot we created it. Forget this idea that Plato found logocentrism. He didn't find it, reveal it, he made it up. And therefore, it's a man-made thing. For Nietzsche, there is no truth apart from what man creates. We create truth, and so it's not absolute. Finally, for Nietzsche, even God is a man-made truth. This is this idea of God is dead. In other words, God didn't create man. Man created God. Okay? And therefore, not only is God dead, but so are all supernatural, transcendent ideas and realities, whether those ideas be theological, philosophical, or aesthetic. Again, nothing is really pure again after that. Everything's just a social construct. And so it cannot hope to say, you know, I'm a perfect standard. This is partly the reason why Nietzsche has to turn to the will to power. If there are no standards anywhere to tell you how to act or how to behave, then the only way that you're going to behave is a will to power. And, you know, that's the side of Nietzsche that we say, oh, maybe he's to blame. Nietzsche's to blame a little bit. We're being a little bit unfair there. But basically, this idea of will to power says that there are no other touchstones. Nothing else tells us what to do because it's all man-made. All that's left is power. All right. In our next lecture, we will turn to the main school of modernism, structuralism.